and during the war.
Perhaps most significantly, obviously, was her contribution on manning guns on Navy ships, guarding Union positions on key rivers, and things of that ilk. But they also played a significant role in ending John Brown's raid and in several land battles during the war. And these are the subject of our presentation tonight. Dan Clendaniel, our guest tonight, retired history teacher, grew up in California, Pennsylvania. I had to look at that two or three times to make sure I wasn't misstating that. And graduated from California University of Pennsylvania in 1978. He lives in Manassas with his wife of 37 years, Mary, who's with us here tonight as well. Welcome, Mary. And Dan was a history teacher, Prince William County, for 34 years. In the last year of his teaching career, he spent as a teacher in residence at the National Museum of the Marine Corps down in Triangle or Quantico, Virginia. A great museum if you've never spent any time down there to go through that. In his retirement, Dan continues to visit local classrooms for programs in which he discusses U.S. Marines' participation in the Civil War, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. He also recently completed a history of his great-grandfather's Civil War regiment, such hard and severe service, the 85th Pennsylvania in the Civil War, which he has copies of that book here tonight if you're interested. Dan, we're thrilled you could join. You and Mary could join us tonight. We look forward to your presentation, so please join me in a Bull Run Roundtable welcome to Dan.
Try to do without. I think I can do without.
Okay. Does he need it on?
No.
Okay.
Can I get to go back a slide?
Did you teach when you taught history?
I taught seventh grade almost exclusively.
Wow. Thank you for your service to our country. Yeah.
I love it. I love the kids. I often say the most problem I had in my teaching career wasn't the kids, it was the adults. Sometimes parents, administrators, sometimes other teachers. I'm not complaining. I had a good time. Is anybody, how many veterans do we have in the audience tonight?
Oh,
wow. Okay, thank you for your service. One of my best friends was a Marine for 20 years. Of course, he's still a Marine, but he was active duty Marines, and then he was a teacher for 20 years. And I always said he got it backwards. He should have taught for 20 years, and that would have prepared him for the leadership battle. How many Marines in the audience tonight? Okay. Okay.
All right.
I want to tell you I'm not. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. I'm a little nervous about having these guys here. They always know. One of the things I admire about Marines, I admire all the branches, obviously. And I'm not a former Marine, but the Marines make it a point to teach Marine Corps history to the Marines. So they're often extremely knowledgeable about the subject. So don't hesitate to correct me if I get something wrong, really. Let's see. How many of you have been to the Marine Corps Museum lately? Let's say in the last year or two. Okay, have you seen the new IMAX theater in the back? If you've been to the museum and you haven't seen the new movie in the back, it's worth going just for that. I really recommend it. My year at the museum, I just had a blast. I'll tell you two stories. One of the problems we had, one of my jobs as a teacher in residence was to greet kids. When they got off the bus, we had tons of field trip kids that came to the museum. One of the advantages we have is the cost. You know what it costs to get in? Free of charge. So we had kids stopping off, sometimes announced, sometimes unannounced. And they would tend to go through the galleries in a big clump of kids, you know, 50 kids, 75 kids. So I was talking to one of the docents one time. The docents were mostly retired Marines. there's one guy who was really, you know, most of the Marines are, I mean, even these 70-80-year-old guys, they're tough guys. I mean, I wouldn't mess with them. But Wally was a little bit laid back, like Wally. And I said to him, I said, Wally, we need to break these kids up. You know, there's too many of them. They're all clumped up. And he thought about it for a second. And he said, well, you know, a hand grenade works pretty well. Not so much Wally. My other favorite story was my favorite day at the museum. As I said, we had kids come all the time, field trip kids. I got a phone call one day, and the assistant principal at the alternative school wanted to bring her kids to the museum. The alternative school were all the kids that with behavior problems that had been kicked out of their schools. So we're talking about between 100 and probably 80 to 100 kids. Needless to say, we were all pretty nervous about it. I know there was one kid, when they got off the bus, I recognized one kid from my old school, Gregory. And I thought, if this is going to be Gregory times 100, this is going to be an interesting day. Well, at the same time, we also had a small private school visiting the museum. They were in their uniforms and all, and they were fine. And what was great was everybody at the museum was on full alert for these kids from the alternative school. The education staff, the security people, the Marines that worked there, the administrators from the school, they were the real heroes, the principal and administrator. And we had no problems. Every time a kid started to act up a little bit, a docent would just say, grab him around the shoulder and say, hey, come over here, let me tell you the Tootsie Roll story. Let me tell you this story. Towards the end of the day, they're about ready to get on the bus, and there's a message on the walkie-talkie. We got a problem in the Korean War gallery. Oh, God. So everybody rushes over there. Guess what? It wasn't the alternative school kids. It was the private school kids. So it was just a great experience. And the other thing, at least a third to half of those kids, they were walking around the museum with their mouths open. They never saw anything like that before. They didn't come from families necessarily where, you know, they would go to the museum on a weekend. And they're looking at these tanks, and so they're aircraft. Yeah. Wow. Perfect timing. And they just had a really good time. So my connections to the Marines are I worked at the museum. My uncle and namesake was a World War II Marine. My nephew Scott is currently a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. So, why John Brown's ready to end the Civil War? Well, the first time I gave this presentation, I started studying about the Marines and the Civil War, and there really wasn't a lot there. There's still not a lot there, in my opinion. So I thought, I got to add John Brown's ready. They played a prominent role in that, as most of you know. So that's why we tacked it on. This is my book. I'm only going to take a minute to talk about it. That's why I got it back there at the table. This is my great-grandfather's regiment I wrote about, the 85th Pennsylvania. Is anybody here from southwestern Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh area? Okay, this is where these guys were from. Washington County, Greene County, Somerset, and Fayette. Okay. And Volume 1 covers the first 2 years of the war. Volume 2, which will be out later this year, covers 1864, 1865. Why would I expect you to buy it tonight when I'm talking about a completely different subject? I don't. I don't have any expectations. I would just encourage you to take a look at the book. The one thing I have going for me, I think, is this. It's got primary sources. I quote 50 men from the regiment. And when I talk about a typical campaign, let's say the Peninsula Campaign, I spend the first few pages giving an overview of the Peninsula Campaign. Then I go back and retell the story of the men telling the story in their own words. And so it's got 600, almost about 650 footnotes in Volume 1 alone. Volume 2 will cover the last 2 years of the war, and Volume 3 will be biographies of all the men. So, okay, that's all I'm talking about that. Museum opened in 2005, and in spite of the fact that there's no Iwo Jima's I'm going to talk about tonight. There's no Belleau Woods. In spite of that, I will say the museum has an excellent Civil War gallery. So if you ever go out, go check it out. It's well worth seeing the Civil War gallery. These are the Civil War uniforms from Revolutionary War up to today. I'm going to be talking about these two. That's what they had for John Brown's raid, and those are Civil War uniforms right there. Okay. Up until and including the Civil War, the Marines had roles to play. They were part of the Navy. They would be sharpshooters. Even to this day, every Marine is a rifleman, and they're going to play this role in the Civil War. They would protect the captain and the officers to keep this from happening, to keep a mutiny from happening.
And thirdly, they would be landing parties. Those were the three major roles. And they're going to do this quite a bit in the Civil War, although there really weren't any exclusive, well, there were some, but I mean, as far as the big engagements, there weren't a lot of exclusive Marine landings. They often did it with the Navy and with the Army. So I'm going to talk about the Marines involved in just several battles. First Bull Run, Cape Hatteras, Fort Sumter, James River, Flotilla, and then Fort Fisher at the end. All right, there's Harper's Ferry today. John Brown, we're almost at the 160th anniversary, aren't we? 5 days from now, of John Brown's invasion. Was he a nut? Was he a nut? I'm asking you. Terrorist?
Yeah.
Was he a prophet? He was a little bit of all those things. I don't think he was, after, even for this presentation tonight, I don't think he was completely crazy. I think he was frustrated. I think he was an Old Testament Christian, you know, a fire and brimstone Christian as compared to a turn the other cheek Christian. I don't think he was a very good military person. I think the planning of the capture of the arsenal was pretty well done. But after that, it kind of went downhill. What is generally considered to be his biggest mistake during the raid? Does anybody know?
Concentrating in the firehouse.
But what almost caused that to happen? Remember the train that came through? What did he do with the train? He stopped it and he let it go. So he had cut the telegraph lines into Harper's Ferry, but after the train went through town, this first chance they had, they stopped at another telegraph and alerted everybody. So the townspeople were fighting John Brown's. There were some militias there from Maryland, I think Virginia too, fighting John Brown. So that's what got him holed up what was he expecting? Was he expecting the slaves to flock to Harper's Ferry? And yet he spent all this time, all this secrecy, and all of a sudden did he plan to be a martyr in the first place? It sure seems that way. I don't know. But I don't think he was completely crazy. Okay, I know some of you know this. Why are the Marines going to be sent to capture him or to stop the rebellion? Why the Marines?
We don't have any army back there. The
exactly.
Army's out west.
The army was all the way down in Fort Monroe. They were too far away. The Navy Yard in Washington, there was a contingent of Marines. That's why they were picked, because they were close by. So their boss is going to be Lieutenant Israel Green. More on him a little bit later. Who's going to lead the troops once they get to Harper's Ferry? Robert E. Lee, who happened to be on leave at the mansion in Arlington.
Settling his father-in-law's estate.
Exactly. Had some personal business. And who was going to be his aide during this? Jeff Stuart, who also happened to be in Washington. He had come from Kansas. He had patented an invention, right, like a saber attachment, right, and he was right at the War Department trying to sell this, and I think they actually bought it for the cavalry when, hey, take this message up to Arlington and give it to Robert E. Lee, and that's how that whole thing came about. But it's because they were close by, that's why they were chosen. Now, remember the uniforms? I showed you you'll see the Civil War. These are still the old uniforms. They had the new uniforms in 1859. For whatever reason, they decided to wear their old-style uniforms when they went to Harper's Ferry. There were about 86 Marines and a few officers, so maybe about 90 in all. So they get there, and John Brown's holed up in the engine house. Some of his band has been killed, his provisional army, some townspeople have been killed. The mayor had been killed. That really upset the townspeople, because he was unarmed. And so when Brown, before the Marines showed up, when Brown sent his son and another raider out to with a white flag, unarmed, they shot Brown's son. I think that was Watson Brown in the stomach, so he crawled back in the engine house. So things were pretty tense when the Marines showed up. So Lee went to the leader of the militia and said, do you want to do it? Do you want to have the honor of storming the engine house? And he said, what? He said, no, that's what you guys are paid to do. We'll step aside for the Marines. So the Marines said, fine. Okay. Also interesting, of course, all three went to the South when the Civil War began. Now, Israel Green was from upstate New York. Why did he fight with the South?
Wife is from Virginia.
Why did, like a lot of other Northerners, he went South because that's where his wife was from. Okay? John C. Pemberton is a good example of that, too, from Philadelphia. His wife was a Southerner. So, happy wife, happy life. This is my second favorite artifact at the National Museum of the Marine Corps. When the first attempt to get inside the engine house where John Brown was holed up with his hostages was they had a couple of sledgehammers. They were batting at the door. Well, the door wouldn't give. The door was tied with a rope, and it had too much give to it. It wasn't real rigid, so when they hit it with the sledgehammers, it just kind of wobbled a little bit. This is the head of one of those sledgehammers. So my first favorite artifact in the museum is obviously the Iwo Jima flag. This is my second favorite. Okay. The provenance of this was fairly easy to prove. It was in the hands of one family for decades, for a century. And they tried hard to figure out how to give it to some museum or some facility in Harper's Ferry. They couldn't work it out, so they went to the Marines and said, yeah, the Marines said, yeah, we'll take it. It didn't take long at all to work that out. So when the sledgehammers didn't work, Israel Green says he saw a 40-foot ladder laying alongside the engine house. So about 20 Marines picked it up. And on the second try, they rammed a little hole in the right-hand side of the door. This depiction, I think, is fairly accurate. Although, I think Green might have been closer to the door, because when they stormed inside, he's the first one through the door, Green is. And in that position, I guess he still could have been, but... and there were about 2,000 spectators watching this whole thing go on. And Green later said, when I got inside the engine house, I had two objectives. Stop the raiders and capture the engine house and capture the raiders. Now think about the hostages. The fact that he didn't mention them almost sounds like he didn't care whether they lived or died. I'm sure he did, but could you imagine if something like this happened today? This is not the way it would be settled. Now, interestingly enough, there were no hostages who were killed in the rush. John Brown actually treated the hostages fairly well. They were in the back. So Jeb Stuart goes up to the door first, and he talks to Brown. And the story is that Jeb Stuart knew Brown from Kansas and recognized him. Now, we were talking about this. I'm not sure how he got that word to Green, because I think up until this time, I'm not sure they knew it was, you know, Osawatomie Brown. Maybe they did, maybe they suspected it, but Green actually recognized him. So when Green leads the Marines in through the door, one of the hostages, Lewis Washington, who was a distant relative, not even a distant relative, a relative of George Washington, said, "Hey, that's Osawatomie over there." Which, it's everybody says that's what he said, but, you know, isn't that amazing? Osawatomie. Why couldn't he say, "Hey, there's Brown. That's Osawatomie over there." So, anyway, Green went after him. Another officer followed him through. The third through was a Marine by the name of Luke Quinn. He was shot in the abdomen. He died later. The next Marine jumped over Quinn's body, Matthew Rupert. He was shot in the cheek. He survived. Luke Quinn was the only Marine killed. They killed two of the raiders. Their bayonets, they stuck them through. Green took a hack at John Brown, hit him in the back of the neck with a saber, and then he tried to run him through, but the blade of the double back, he did not have he had his ceremonial sword. It wasn't strong. So, but he continued to club John Brown. You know, if he'd had his regular saber, John Brown would have been dead right there, no question at all. And you wonder how things might have been a little bit different if that had happened. So this depiction is pretty famous. My only problem with this is they seem to show, I'm guessing this is Quinn, and maybe this is Rupert. They show them on the inside, on the outside of the engine house before the door is broken down. And, you know, maybe that was just the artist wanted to show that, but they were actually wounded inside. This depiction, not accurate at all. It looks like Green comes in and the first thing he does is shoot John Brown. Now that didn't happen. This one looks to be fairly accurate. This is Green coming down on Brown's head. Some of the Raiders are over here dying, and Marines are still storming through. So out of the ones that I've seen, that's probably the most accurate. Brown is put on trial in Charleston. Interestingly, he was not allowed to testify in his own defense. State law said you cannot, that the witness or the defendant cannot take the stand. He was allowed to speak after the trial. And on his way to the gallows in early December, he handed this note to one of the guards. And basically, he's predicting the Civil War. I thought we could do this with a little bit of bloodshed to get rid of slavery. Now we can see it's going to take a lot of bloodshed. And he was right. So it's like I said, madman, terrorist, prophet, maybe a little bit of all of it. So about 10 years ago, 2010, some Marine veterans got together and erected this monument to Luke Quinn. We don't really know what he looked like. He was an Irish immigrant. But he was the only Marine killed, the only person killed in the storming, and some people consider him to be the first casualty of the Civil War. This is a list of casualties, Marine Corps casualties. These are deaths in the first column and wounded in the second column. And you can see Marine Corps losses in the Civil War were comparatively very small. What's interesting to me is there were more Marines that were killed than were wounded. Isn't that interesting? And then you come down here to World War I, only about 23% were killed. And then come down here to the War on Terror, maybe 10%. What do you think? Why do you think the less people died out of the casualties? You got, go ahead. The corpsmen and the medics are treating the men on the field. If you got shot in the Civil War, you're right, you could lie in the battlefield all night long, you know, in agony and pain. Maybe somebody would come to you, maybe they wouldn't, but I think that's probably, plus the medicine just improved. But as you can see, the Civil War casualties for the Marine Corps, not overly great. So when war broke out, many Confederates went south. About a third of the officers, the officer corps was hit pretty hard in the Marine Corps, more so than the Army and the Navy. This is Lloyd Beall. He became the Commandant of the Marines. And this is Henry Tyler, Prince William County. He became one of the main officers, too. There's some reenactors. Now, it says 1,250. There were never more than 600 in the Confederate Marine Corps at any one time. So, and they're going to do the traditional jobs of the Marine. They're going to guard bases, naval bases, probably the main thing they did. They are going to become involved in combat a couple of times. I'll mention one shortly. It was a brother against brother war. Here are two brothers in the Marine Corps. Philip stayed with the Union. James went to the South. They almost fought each other against each other twice. Once on the James River and once in Mobile Bay, but at the last minute, one or the other got pulled out. Their father, they were cousins of Robert E. Lee, second cousins. Their father was the first cousin of Robert E. Lee. All right, First Manassas, First Bull Run. We know how the Union Army was incredibly green at Bull Run, right? Well, if the Army was green, the Marines were phosphorescent green. When they marched out of the Navy Yard, there were about 350 Marines. Most of them had only been in the Marine Corps for about 2 or 3 weeks. They were trained on the march to Bull Run. So when we talk about their performance and how it was denigrated at Manassas, keep in mind that their training was extremely raw. So they get to the battlefield, they're in Porter's division, they're in a reserve role, they're guarding a battery. And so that's what they think their role is. And by the way, they were tired, they were hungry when they showed up, they were spent. Then they're going to be sent to Henry Hill to back up Burnside's men. Well, about the time they got to the top of Henry Hill, where Mrs. Henry was in her house, Burnside's men are starting to withdraw. Burnside's men have been fighting all day. They're tired. They're running out of ammunition. So this battery they're guarding is up on Henry Hill. About that time, a group of bluecoats start advancing toward them. Are they ours or are they theirs? Well, Griffin, who's in charge of one of the batteries, starts arguing with a guy named Barry, who is McDowell's head of artillery. Those are ours. I tell you, well, Barry wins out, and these guys got to within 70 yards, and then they opened fire, and they decimated the battery and the Marines. There they are. So they were Confederates in blue uniforms. Oops. That might have been me. I hit button. Anyway, so the Marines retreat down the hill. They leave the battery. They retreat along with three other regiments. And by the way, they weren't the first regiment to leave the field. Their commander, Major John G. Reynolds, rallies them. They try to take the hill back. They're unsuccessful. They come back down the hill. They try a third time. They get about halfway up the hill. Then that's it. Then they see everybody retreating. The great skedaddle is on. And the Marines are part of that. But it should be remembered, they probably fought better than a lot of Union regiments did that day. Their commandant, a man named John Harris, back in Washington, said this is the first time in recorded history the Marines have shown their back to the enemy. Now, this is their own commandant saying this. Why would he say such a thing? The only thing I can figure out is maybe he was jealous that he didn't go himself. He was about 68 years old. And Reynolds was ordered to take command of the regiment, not Harris. Remember the commandant before Harris, Archibald Henderson, who had been commandant for 38 years? During the Indian Wars of the 1830s, down in Florida and so forth, he put a note on his door, he tacked a note on it, he says, gone off to Florida to fight the Indians, be back when the war is over. So he was a commandant that was in charge of his men. Maybe Harris expected to be that kind of leader too, but he wasn't. So, you know, we're going to see later on the Marines are going to get scapegoated for Fort Fisher as well, but that was by the Navy. It's kind of hard when they get blasted and lambasted by one of their own. I think it was uncalled for. I think they fought pretty well that day. About a month later, they are going to be involved in a combined Army-Navy effort to capture two forts at the base of Cape Hatteras. Can I try? Okay. And this was called the Battle of Cape Hatteras Inlet. There were two forts, two Confederate forts. Cape Hatteras, shown here, Fort Hatteras and Fort Clark. They were very poorly manned and not gunned very. They didn't have very good weaponry. I think Fort Hatteras had 10 guns and Fort Clark had two. So if you're looking south, the landing force is going to be landed above them, north of them, and they're going to charge down through the heat and the sand. And by the time they get there, Fort Clark is already given up. They're being bombarded from the ocean by a squadron, a Union flotilla, and Fort Clark gives up. The Confederates inside there scurry into Fort Hatteras. Hatteras has the same problem, basically. They can't match guns with the Union Navy, so they end up surrendering. So the Marines that were involved in the land assault, it was pretty much inconsequential, although they were part of it. Who was the Union general in charge of this?
Burnside.
No?
Burnside.
My favorite Civil War general to read about. Benjamin Butler. Spoon's Butler. More about him later. In fact, the Confederate leader would refuse to surrender to him. He said, no, I'll surrender to Stringfellow, the Navy commander. I'm not going to surrender to Benjamin Butler. So even then, his reputation wasn't so great. Early March, at Hampton Roads, the Merrimack shows up to Virginia and wreaks havoc for a day. Here it is ramming the Cumberland, the USS Cumberland, which sinks. About 130 crewmen are killed, about 20 or 30 of whom are Marines. The next day, the monitor shows up and evens the score a little bit more. So Marines were involved in that. And there were Marines on the Merrimack, too. There were no Marines on the monitor, probably because of its size and the way it was built, but there were Marines on the Merrimack. Next month, April of 1862, New Orleans is captured. Who was the Union General in charge of the occupation? Benjamin Butler. And by the way, I give him credit for that. I think he was a good occupier. And I think he championed the black soldiers. Other than that, he was awful. Bad person. Spoons, Butler, and all that. But this is one of his triumphs, I think. So the Marines are going to hold the city by themselves, a battalion, for 3 days, which is pretty remarkable. The first thing they do, they're going to go into the city hall, the custom house, and the mint, and put up the American flag. When they get to the mint, they put up the American flag, and some Confederates, unhappy with this, take the American flag down and drag it through the streets, led by a gentleman named William Mumford. Butler finds out about this. Mumford is captured, and 2 months later, he's hung from the mint in front of a big, pretty large crowd. I don't know if it was justified or not. I do know that it may have helped to keep the populace pacified. I mean, Butler held the city with about 10,000 troops, but it was considered an outrage. The Confederates put a price on Butler's head, led by Jefferson Davis, said if we capture him, we're going to hang him. And that's interesting, because who did Butler nominate for president in 1860? Jefferson Davis. He thought Jefferson Davis, he was a Democrat then, he thought Jefferson Davis would unify the Democratic Party. And now Jefferson Davis is after his head. That's part of the flag, by the way. Now, one of the things the Confederates said later was, technically, when Mumford pulled the flag down, it hadn't surrendered yet. It hadn't formally surrendered yet. So to them, it wasn't the act of treason that Butler said it was. I think that's being a little picky. I'm not saying he deserved to be executed, but, you know, I guess timing is everything. So you make up your own mind on that. In May of 1862, General McClellan and his huge army is on the Virginia Peninsula. They've landed, they're marching their way up through, I guess they're probably about Williamsburg by this time. So a Union flotilla, he's ordered to send a Union flotilla up the James River towards Richmond. Here's Richmond up here, about 8 miles away. This is Fort Darling, okay? Here's the Galena, this is gonna be an ironclad. Here's the original Monitor. And I think this is a Naugatuck, I think this is another ironclad. And two or three wooden ships are with them. So, if McClellan had acted more promptly, I think he could have walked into Richmond, but he gave the time for the Confederates to put river obstructions in the river. This is an 1865 picture of those obstructions. So I don't know that it looked like that in 1862, but that's a period piece. And Fort Darling, there were also sharpshooters, Confederate sharpshooters on both shores. The sharpshooters on this side were from the Merrimack. The Merrimack had been scuttled. The Confederates realized they couldn't hold the Norfolk Navy Yard, and they also realized that the Merrimack, the draft was too low. It couldn't go to Richmond, so they had to scuttle it. So the Marines are going to be on this shore performing as sharpshooters. There's another Marine Corps contingent over here, and there's about 10 guns or so. There's some guns over here, too, at Chapin's Bluff. But here's Fort Darling. The Galena is going to get hammered. They're going to be hit 43 times. 19 of the shells penetrate the deck, the iron-plated deck. This ironclad, the Naugatuck had to withdraw. Its main gun wouldn't work. The Monitor came up to help the Galena, but it couldn't elevate its guns high enough to hit Fort Darling. Okay. Fort Darling was 100 feet there. This is just who's been to Fort Darling? We were talking about it. It's fabulous, fabulous site. So the Galena is going to stay there and cover the withdrawal. So during the battle, 3 straight Confederate shells penetrate the deck and decimate. What's the below deck guns called? Not the ones on top. What are the ones on along the side called? Anyway, that level, they're decimated. So the Navy is decimated. That's when this guy steps up and says, come on, boys, here's a chance for the Marines. This is John Mackey. He rallies the Marines, take the guns, and they continue to fire at the Confederates until the battle is over. John Mackey is a corporal. He's from New York. In July, President Lincoln visits, and he gets on. He does a look over the Galena, and he looks at the crew and says, I can't believe any of you survived. That's when they brought up John Mackey and two other sailors and said, hey, these are the three heroes. So Lincoln turns around, looks at Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles and says, I want them promoted, and I want them to get a Medal of Honor. So two things. It's the first time the president has personally authorized the Medal of Honor, and the only time, and John Mackey is the first Marine to receive the Medal of Honor in the history of the Marine Corps. Okay, we're going to jump ahead to 1863, September 1863. This is Charleston Harbor. Here's the city of Charleston right here, Fort Sumter. This is Morris Island. Here's Fort Wagner here from the movie Glory, 54th Mass. This is Battery Gregg, some other Confederate guns. Here's the Union blockade. So, on September the 7th, Battery Wagner surrenders, and Battery Gregg is evacuated. So, they're in Union hands. So now, the Army and the Navy both have a goal of capturing Fort Sumter. Interestingly, they both formulated their own plans without telling the other what they were going to do. Okay? They finally met. Gilmore, the Army commander, met with Dahlgren, the Navy commander, and they both insisted that, hey, Dahlgren says, I want a Navy guy in charge, and Quincy Gilmore says, no, it's got to be an Army guy, so they couldn't agree, so they finally did it on their own. Well, Gilmore called his assault off because of the low tide. So on the night of September the 8th, about 400 sailors and 100 Marines are going to assault Fort Sumter. Complete disaster. 25 boats were launched, only about 5 or 10 made it to the shore. Once they got there, they said, hey, we should have brought some ladders with us, you know, because the walls of Fort Sumter were massive. I mean, I guess they figured on climbing up the walls, but the Confederates knew they were coming. Back in April, during an ironclad assault in Charleston Harbor, which failed, one of the Union ironclads, the Keokuk, was sunk. And the Confederates went and got the Union signal book. So they knew the Union signals. They knew when and where it was going to happen. So about 100 to maybe 120 sailors and Marines were captured, 35 to 40 Marines. Half of them were paroled, the other half sent to Andersonville, where most of them died. And isn't it interesting, Fort Sumter, it took one day for the Confederates to capture Fort Sumter, and the Union took 4 years to take it back. More on that later. Okay, the last campaign I want to talk about involving Marines was January of 1865, the last year of the war. Here's Wilmington, the last port that's open to the south, and Fort Fisher is down here guarding the entry on both sides to Wilmington. So the Union is going to assault. In December, they're going to assault under the command of General Butler, which is a complete failure. So they're going to try again in January. This time, General Terry's in charge. So the plan is, this is looking south, if you can imagine this. This is looking north, I should say. The Union, the Army, is going to land about a mile above on the peninsula at Curie Beach. They're going to assault on this side. It's going to be the job of the Marines and the Navy to assault on this side. Now, I think the Admiral at that time, David Porter, I think he just wanted to get on the Glory. He's in charge. The leader of the Navy is going to be Kidder Breeze, and the commander of the Marines is going to be Lucien Dawson. Now, the Marines' job is going to be to get close to the beach, dig in. They have shovels. They're going to dig in. And then when the Navy personnel, the 400 Navy assault, they're going to provide cover. That was the plan. Well, part of the problem is that the Navy under Porter's command is back here, so they're shooting over the heads of his own men into the fort, and there were some casualties due to friendly fire. So Breeze takes his men and puts them on the beach instead. There was a big sand dune, so they're actually more protected over here on the beach. And he was waiting until 2 o'clock to assault. One of the other mistakes the Navy made was they tried to assault the fort with a pistol and a cutlass, very dashing. And The Army had landed the day before, so they were fresh as daisies. The Union, the Navy guys and the Marines were worn out. In fact, one of the Marines said, "I couldn't wait to assault the fort. I just wanted to get in and get my hands on some Confederate rations." So according to Porter, the assault was supposed to be coordinated at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Terry, on the other hand, said it was scheduled for 3 o'clock, and his guys didn't even set out until 3:30. So you have 500 Marines and sailors assaulting this side of the fort. Lam, the commander inside the fort for the Confederates, is going to concentrate all of his firepower on them, and they're going to be decimated. Here's a pretty good little drawing of showing the Navy and the Marines trying to assault that bastion. Finally, at 3:30, by the way, the only good that came out of it was they did create a diversion. So when the Army is going to assault the other side, it's going to be pretty wide open for them. And Fort Fisher did fall. Later on, because of the high number of casualties, they asked Porter what went wrong. Guess who he blamed? The Marines. Got to find a scapegoat. It wasn't their fault. That's what it looked like from the Confederate perspective. Pretty much sitting ducks. Now, one Navy officer, Ensign Robley Evans, Fighting Bob Evans, was injured. Shot 4 times. Shot in the leg, he bandaged himself up, he kept going. Then he was shot in the knee, and the knee in the other leg. Here he is. And a young Marine by the name of Henry Wasmuth picked him up and carried him on his back to a crater hole, a bomb crater. Saved his life. And while he's tending to young Robley Evans, Evans is telling him, "Hey, you need to get down too." He shot, Wasmuth is shot through the neck, and he bleeds out, he dies. Mm-hmm. Robley Evans goes on to a long career in the Navy. This is him in 1907, more than 40 years later. He's going to lead the Great White Fleet around the world for President Teddy Roosevelt. But he says, speaking of Henry Wasmuth, he said he was an honor to his uniform. On April the 4th, the day after Richmond is abandoned by the Confederates, President Lincoln lands with his son. Now, and he says, there was, I still, this is fascinating, isn't it? The day after Richmond fall, the war isn't even over yet, and he's taking a stroll through the enemy's capital. Could you imagine Truman driving through Tokyo before the atomic bombs hit, or riding through Berlin in late April of 18? I mean, this is what this is like. He was protected by Navy and Marines. Now, this picture shows Navy. I think the Marines were in the rowboat rowing him up to the shore. But once he got there, who protected Lincoln? The African Americans recognized him, and they all came to him and thanked him for the emancipation. So he was in pretty good hands. 10 days later, Fort Sumter.
May I have your attention, please? The time is now 8:30 p.m. The library closes in 30 minutes at 9 p.m. If you need to call for a ride home, please do so now. For library assistance, please see a staff member. Thank you.
Does anybody know what's significant about this flag they put up that day, sir?
That was the flag that Anderson took down in 1861.
Correct. And Anderson was there for the flag raising. Now, this was a big event, but it got almost no attention. Why? It happened on the same day. A couple hours later, Lincoln was assassinated in Washington. But there was a Marine Guard there for the ceremony at Fort Sumter. Excuse me. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, sir.
What kind of training did they get?
Not very good. I would say that Bull Run, it was incredibly poor. After that, it got a little bit better. But remember, the officers, they have to train the officers first before they can train the men. And the officer corps was decimated by those that went to the Confederacy, like Israel Green and people like that. So I would say the training wasn't that magnificent. I would say that it wasn't a bad duty. One of the problems they had recruiting was that, by 1862, some of the states and counties were offering bounties My great-grandfather took advantage of that. He got a $300 bounty to join in 1862, paid at $50, 6 months intervals. The Marines didn't have anything like that. But the attractive thing to me about being a Marine was it was relatively safe compared to being in the Army. Of course, in World War II, you're fighting Japanese, an enemy that won't surrender. It's completely the opposite. But I don't think the training was that great until they got their officer school built up. Does that make sense? Yes, sir.
Why did you get interested in this? What motivated you?
Working at the museum. You mean about the Civil War or the Marines?
About the Marines.
I found working with the Marines to be a tremendous experience. So I was walking through the Naked Marines Gallery about boot camp, and I saw a little sign on the wall that said, "The Marines are taught the worst thing they can do is let down a fellow Marine." And I learned about the teamwork and the camaraderie and the leadership they teach. And that's just how I became interested in the Marines. They're not perfect. I said they swear too much. But veterans in general, it's a pretty, pretty great group of men and women. So it's fun to tell their story. Yes, ma'am.
If I were in the Marine Corps Museum in the Civil War Gallery, where is that sledgehammer head?
Pretty much at the beginning. What you're going to do is you're going to go through a gallery on the Mexican War, the storming of Chapultepec Castle, and right at the end there's John Brown, sledgehammer, the big mural, and then over on this wall is John Mackey, and then you walk through and you see some stories about Fort Sumter and some of those, and the Gettysburg Address. But
it's pretty small, right?
The sledgehammer head?
Right.
Yeah, you got it. Right about that. It's about that big. Absolutely. Very prominently displayed then.
Prominently displayed. Okay.
Yes.
Can't
miss it. Yes, sir.
Given the normal duty they would have, you know, on board ship and that kind of thing, when they were put on a land operation, what kind of weaponry were they given compared to what the Army had?
I don't know. I can't specifically tell. Maybe somebody in here knows. I don't know that. I don't know that answer specifically. So I'm not gonna guess.
Okay. But you did say, you know, they were used as sharpshooters though.
Yes.
In key places. So
yes.
There they would tend to have a much better.
You would think, wouldn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. You would think. Yeah.
You would think they would have a decent weapon, but yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was just from practice. They could. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're just better at it. But yeah, good point. Yeah. Yes, sir.
That offers hurry from that. You mentioned that there was a question about who was Brown with the attack work. One of the histories that I read had Stewart up at the door talking to Brown before it all
Correct,
started.
For several minutes.
Yeah, trying to get him to give up.
Right.
And at that time, Stewart said no, and that's when they were.
I don't think the plan was ever that he was going to give up. I think Lee knew he wasn't going to give up. You know, Brown's condition was give a safe passage out of town, give us a head start, and there's no way. I think Stewart just wanted to see, confirm it was Brown, and see, get a little bit of a lay if you could to see what was going on inside. But I don't think there was any expectation that he was going to give up. I think from the get-go it was going to be, we're going to storm this bad boy and kill or capture them. And what was the first thing you mentioned about?
No, we were talking about who was...
See, that's the question I had. Why did they need Jeb Stewart to confirm it was Brown? Weren't there pictures of Brown that were available? He was pretty well known from the Kansas days. Mm-hmm. Plus, when he was in Kansas, he didn't have a beard. And in Harper's Ferry, he had the long, flowing beard. So his appearance was a little obscured from what Jeb Stewart would have recognized. I mean, did they really need Jeb Stewart to confirm that it was? And even if it wasn't John Brown, did it really make that much of a difference?
Didn't Stewart take his hat off?
Yeah, what was it called? The kind he wore in the Civil War. What was the kind of hat that Stewart had with the long plume on the back? Anyway, yeah, he did. That was the signal to rush. Yes, sir.
So we're not too terribly far removed from the shores of Tripoli when all this took place.
Right.
Was the size and the equipment that the Marine Corps had at the start of the Civil War that dramatically different?
Probably not. No. The Marine Corps was just, as I said, it was part of the Navy. They were always small. I mean, when you think about it, one of the things we teach in World War I, there were as many Marines killed at Bellawood in World War I as the entire history of the Marine Corps up until that point. So They were small. They had very, very specific duties. In fact, in early 1909, Teddy Roosevelt ordered them to be taken off the ships. They didn't need them on the ironclad ships anymore, the steel boats. They didn't need them to enforce discipline, and they were actually taken off the ships. And that's when the head of the army, Leonard Wood, said, "Oh, let's make them part of the army." That's when people freaked out and said, "No, we're not going to become part of the army." And Teddy Roosevelt had to put them back on the ships. And then in the early 1900s, the Marines were fighting in the so-called banana wars down in Central America. And so when World War I came around, they were ready to fight. You know, we had a very small army, but the Marine, that's why they were sent to Europe to fight with the army in World War I, because they were seasoned by that time. They started to grow larger. Yes, sir.
I've read where the Marines in the Civil War, at least at the beginning, tended to have more obsolete equipment because they didn't get rid of their flint locks until the 1850s.
Is that right? Wow. So they were behind. Yeah. Well, you know, you talked about the sharpshooter role, which is extremely important. Maybe the 1840s and 50s was a relatively docile time for the Navy. You know, there weren't a lot of landings, and we weren't at war with anyone. Mexico, we had the landing, but it wasn't like they were shooting on the shore when they landed at where Monterey or whatever in Mexico. So, you know, I think maybe the Marine Corps was kind of searching for that role at that time. What's their role now, by the way? Would you say? Pretty much the first responders, right? That's what they're ready for, just about anything now. So, good point though. Anybody else? Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, this concludes our meeting for this month. We look forward to seeing you at Bristow Station this weekend and the tour on the 26th.